For the average person in North America, a trip to the doctor usually means three options: drugs, surgery, or radiation. The unofficial motto of what has somehow been assigned the name traditional medicine may be find the bad part and kill it. In truth, that method of operation, or stance toward reality, extends to many things besides healthcare. One need only look at U.S. foreign policy circa 2008 and understand. But the bad part of any patient is only a symptom, and rarely does curing a symptom have anything to do with the root of a problem, unless the root itself has been determined and then is treated. That's where Solaheen Tom and his remarkable process comes in. Solaheen Tom is a cranial osteopath and acupuncturist and co-founder of Ad Humanitas, an organization that says it provides tools for the human journey. Using what he calls ontological kinesiology, he's created a dialogue system and precise protocol to access subconscious information within a human to go as deep as any scientifically based method I have ever experienced. Solaheen, nice to talk to you.
Thank you.
Dr. Andrew Taylor Still, the man credited with the foundation of osteopathy, had some tremendous personal tragedies and Civil War battlefield experiences that left him disillusioned with what was then considered traditional medicine. He thought that kind of medicine barbaric. Mm-hmm. Was there an early experience that led you to a different understanding of how healing should be accomplished?
Yes, there was. It actually takes me back to the time when I was in Afghanistan. And I had a remarkable experience one day. I happened to be running through the bazaar in Kabul and was wearing no shoes. Actually, I was sort of dressed as an Afghani. This is many years ago, so I'm slightly embarrassed to sort of talk about it. But I ran through this bazaar and suddenly came across a woman who was sort of barring my route. And she was dressed in a burqa, which is this idea of a sort of sack with a little grill in where her eyes were. And I happened to be looking into this grill because it was the only thing I could really sort of see that sort of moved and was animated. And there was this wonderful pair of green eyes. And we had this sort of cinematographic moment of looking at each other and realizing that we were in a rather tricky atmosphere because this is in Afghanistan. We turned and then again turned back and looked at each other.
And you don't do this in that culture.
Certainly you wouldn't normally, and certainly not now. This is a long time ago. This is since 1970. And so what happens, we turned back and looked at each other and had this sort of actually very glorious moment of sort of liberation, of looking at each other as man and woman, even though I couldn't really see her. And then I turned, and as I turned, I hit my toe against a large rock and took the entire top of the toe off and the nail and everything. There was sort of blood spurting everywhere. She, meanwhile, disappeared, and I sort of hobbled into this shop, which was next door, or next to me. And
a rug shop.
A rug shop, yes. You've probably heard the story. A rug shop, it was. I was dripping blood everywhere. And fortunately, I think the blood was the same color as the dye of the rugs. And I was sort of in shock, and I was sort of sitting there. And suddenly the door opens. There's no one else in the shop. And this little old man comes in, and he's sort of dressed in white, and he's got a long beard, and he's rather crooked. And he's also tutting. And the interesting thing is that in Afghanistan, they put this stuff underneath their lower lip. So it's sort of like a tobacco-y stuff called naswa.
Just a pinch between your cheek and gum.
Well, it's actually, yes, but they shriek like this, and you can hardly hear what they're talking about. But anyway, he comes in and he's chewing this stuff, and he looks at me and he tuts, and he takes out his tin of this chewing tobacco, if you like, and he spits on it. So, you know, me going, there's the tubercular germs and whatnot, you know. And he takes the skin of my toe and he plonks it back and puts the nail back. And it was really a mess. And he dabs this green stuff on. And that stems the bleeding. And then he starts to recite the Quran. So, Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, Alhamdulillah Rabbil Alameen, down my leg a couple of times. Looks at me, walks out, and I never see him again. So I'm sort of sitting there, going, you know, not sure what on earth was happening, but realized that something momentous had happened because the bleeding had stopped and this seemingly had come out of the blue.
And the pain?
And the pain, yes, I think the pain, I mean, it's a long time ago now, was probably fairly intense, but it had sort of began to settle. There's probably some narcotic in the sort of chewing stuff there. Anyway, so I walked, you know, hobbled back actually through the bazaar again, you know, not wearing shoes, so I'm, you know, dust everywhere. And it was my monthly bath that evening in Kabul, and particularly nowadays, but certainly then.
Hygiene was very important to you.
Well, there was very little wood in the capital, and they had to bring it into Kabul from about 30, 40 miles away on the backs of human donkeys. There's lots of different tribes that make up Afghanistan, and there's a particular tribe called the Haziras, who are the sort of porters, and they're sort of lower, or seen as the lower classes, in fact seen as the donkeys, unfortunately, of the human society in Afghanistan in those days. And they were the sort of wood carriers. And they would carry the wood on their backs into Afghanistan, into Kabul every day, but it was so expensive that you could only have a bath once a month, certainly on my budget. Anyway, so I'm having this shower, bath, pouring water onto me that evening. And as I wash rather gingerly my toe, all this green stuff comes off, and suddenly I see my toe, and it's completely healed.
What was the time span on this?
Oh, 5-6 hours, something like that. It was really quite remarkable. So I was sort of blown away. I mean, I really hadn't seen anything like that. I come from a doctoring family. My father's a doctor. I'd actually never really been ill in my life. My dad had never been ill. We lived a life that was pretty charmed in a way, and so I'd never really seen the inside of a hospital, let alone anything else. And this was the first time that I had sort of been transported into a healing modality that was completely beyond my understanding. So it was a fairly remarkable moment.
And it's important to figure out how you got from there to osteopathy, but there's a PS. There's a carbuncular PS to the story, is there not?
Well, yes, there is. About 6 or 7, actually probably more than that, maybe 10 years ago, we started to write our first book, and we decided we'd better go off to the coast and get out of the house and get out of the, you know, away from the telephone. And there I was with my computer typing away this story I just told you. And I suddenly became aware of my sacrum, the base bone on my back. And it started sort of itch. And as I was typing more and more, it started to get even sorer. And by the end of the day, I had a carbuncle on my bum, actually on my sacrum. And it was sort of, you know, half an inch high and probably an inch and a half wide. I mean, it was huge. And so I decided to do some work on it. Now, we'll probably explain what work means during this interview, but what I really sort of looked at was what did this carbuncle really infer and mean, and the information that I was able to elicit using my wife to help me to do this was that sitting in my sort of foundation, because the sacrum is known as the foundational bone, it's the sacred bone of our body, and we rise from it. So in my foundation, sitting in there, and somehow initiated or inserted was a sort of force that prevented me from being healed. Now, you know, what actually arose was that this action of this man all those years ago had either triggered or suppressed, and I can't truly tell you exactly now, but had pulled up inside me a sort of internal dialogue that said, someone else will heal me.
That you are not capable of healing
yourself.
Got it.
So his action placed inside me, or pulled up inside me, probably pulled up inside me, the feeling that, or the internal dialogue that says, Salahin, you can't heal yourself, you have to go to someone else.
So this was maybe a mistaken belief that you had, or some kind of agreement that you made on some level.
Probably. I think it was probably coded, i.e. it was in my genetic instructions that actually you can't heal yourself. You have to go to the priest, you have to go to the doctor, you have to go to somewhere else, someone in power with knowledge, with understanding that will heal you.
And having a father who was a doctor, mm-hmm. he would suggest that it's in your genetics to go along with this hierarchy.
Well, got it, and particularly his work was actually in preventive medicine, which is probably why I'm doing what I do. And what he did was, we lived in Kuwait for nearly 18 years, and his job was actually to inoculate all the Arabs and the sort of white people who were in the oil company where we lived and worked. And so his modeling was, you humans can't actually heal yourselves. We have to inoculate or vaccinate you so that we engender a, if you like, a prophylactic process within yourself, so that actually when you meet tuberculosis, or you meet smallpox or measles, you can actually deal with it. So it's this sort of idea that we humans really don't have the capacity to heal ourselves. We need sort of a boost. And inoculation and vaccination is really, a way that you're stimulating your own system to sort of recognize viruses, well, not viruses, but bacteria, et cetera, that actually can affect you.
So from there to osteopathy, mm-hmm. How does that all come about?
Gosh.
And maybe we could talk about what osteopathy is, because in terms of traditional American Medical Association medicine, osteopathy is seen as being rather out there.
Yes, although it was sort of hijacked in about 1950, where the osteopaths actually sort of joined the ranks of the AMA. Originally, it was really the model was that the physical body is like a house, in that you've got windows, you've got doors, you've got a skeleton, you've got everything hanging off this skeletal system, and that going through the metaphorical doors and windows of our own body, i.e. what we call the foramina, or the pathway through which nerve fibers or arteries or veins go through, that the sort of integrity of this house, i.e. your body, actually dictates the way that your vascular system, your lymphatic system, your neurological system work, because these doorways through which these pathways flow can be disturbed by muscular contraction, by fascial restriction, by, in other words, your body not doing its job properly. So the model of osteopathy was that if you fix the body, actually health could then return to the system. So it was really based on mechanics. And you mentioned the founder, Andrew Taylor Stills, that he was really a sort of amateur engineer. And he looked at the body at a sort of engineering level and sort of said, gosh, this body is extraordinary idea. You've got these legs and feet and hips and pelvis, and you've got your spine and everything working perfectly normally. And look what happens when you get sick. And he started to look that sick people carried their bodies in a totally different way. And he started to see that actually when you were sick, your physical structure was also disturbed. And so if you fixed the physical structure, you enable them to actually then reorganize their internal structure and get better.
I'm like I have to swallow. I'm losing my voice or something.